just not enough. Oh, oh, man. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, man. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, man.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. We're in for a lot of commentaries today. Some I've written. Others will come from Dr. Bruce Levine about would we have drugged Albert Einstein, how anti-authoritarianism is deemed a mental health problem. Well, I sign up for that. And also from Professor Henry Giroux, unfashionable fascism, mainstream politicians switching sides under Trump's regime of barbarism. And also, where it all began, the dawn of fake news. And that's from Counterpunch, David McRae. Time permitting today, we're also going to give you a little background on John Bolton. I'm sure you've seen him. He looks like a walrus, has that huge mustache, but he's a neocon, and that's just about all anybody knows. Well, we're going to fill in the rest of it today. We're going to give you a complete history of John Bolton and why, in my personal opinion, he is one of the most dangerous human beings on the entire planet. What could possibly go wrong? Well, I predict right now that there will be a war against Iran by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United States, United Kingdom, and France within the next 24 months or sooner. And because Israel is beating the drums for war, and America and the sycophants we are to Israel are lining up, but Bolton is the cheerleader. He's the one who is just dancing down that road, so you'll know about him. Also, recently we were told that we had to act to protect American security and to show that Syria's Assad regime was wrong to use sarin gas on its own people in Doha, a community right beside, actually one of the suburbs of Damascus. We told you at the time that there made no sense. He had absolutely nothing militarily to gain and everything to lose. And others said the same thing. And then reporters began to go there. No American reporters, of course. They're all, at that time, uninterested in the truth. But we're all saying how important it was to show him a lesson. Well, we will give you people today that actually were on the scene during the conflict and can tell you the truth. This is the fourth person whose information we've brought you about this. And this is a Brazilian award-winning documentarian and journalist. And it's a very interesting piece. And I want to thank Jimmy Dore, who did a really good job in this interview. Jimmy does his own little podcast, and he hits on some very important progressive themes. And I always like to acknowledge the people who are doing good work out there. He's one. So we're going to do that. So we have a lot to share, and we always begin with health, so let's start. I'm sure, like myself, there are times in a day where you simply say, got to take a little break, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. And each of us takes a break in our own way. I like it where it's quiet. I can just sit and look out at the beautiful New York skyline. I see Central Park. To my left, I see Riverside Drive and Hudson River. To my right, I see all of downtown unobstructed. And at nighttime, it's just magical with the lights. I gave up a really treasured New York City apartment that I had for 20 years, which was big, huge, four bedrooms, sunken living room, to get this one, which is about half the size, but spectacular views. And there's where, with no phone calls, I turn off the phones, I just relax. And if I want to lie down and meditate, I do so. It doesn't take long, but suddenly you wake up and you're more relaxed, you're more energized. Now, I'm sure many of you do something similar. It might be if you live out by the ocean in Brooklyn, Long Branch, Long Beach. You go out and you sit on the boardwalk and you look at the ocean. Or if you live up at Woodstock, and many people listening right now, because the station up there is playing this program, you have those beautiful mountains in the Catskills. Wherever you're at, quiet time. This is from Heriot-Watt University. Quiet rest contributes to retaining detailed memories. This was published in Nature Science Reports, a major peer-reviewed journal. So what it amounts to is this: a brief rest can result in the retention of more detailed memories relative to being busy in the minutes following learning. I don't have any now. It's out of print, but I used to give away, I must have given away 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 copies as gifts of Living in the Moment, Prescription for the Soul. I've written the sequel. It's just I haven't gotten around to publishing it because I've had no time. But I would ask people, there's 22 chapters. When you read a chapter, then turn off all electronic appliances, no radio, no telephones, nothing. And just take a breath of deep air, relax, because that's going to help you retain it. And indeed, that's the feedback I got. Whereas if someone was reading it and eating and then the television was on and they went right over the computer, they would have forgot it. So that was correct what I was suggesting, but I'm sure many of you also know that you retain more when you're in a quiet place. It only requires about 10 minutes. That's it. And hence we retain more information. So that's also a message for the college students listening now as well. When you study, when you read something, when you're watching a video that you have to retain, turn it off and then just be in a quiet place for about 10 to 20 minutes. Taking a sauna is good, but did you know it also reduces your risk of having a stroke? Oh yeah, Cambridge University, Innsbruck University, Emory University, Leicester University, Bristol University, and universities of Eastern Finland all have done a 15-year follow-up study. And they say that frequent sauna bathing is associated with a reduced risk of stroke. That's good. By as much as 61%. That is tremendous reduction. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Just remember, stroke is one of the leading causes of disability worldwide, placing a heavy human and economic burden on societies. And the reduced risk associated with sauna bathing was found by the teams of scientists at all these different universities. So it's not difficult. In fact, you can now they're so inexpensive, you can buy a small. The infrared saunas, where it pulses different light frequencies off your body, and that's an additional enhancement above and beyond just the dry heat. Or you can also put a little bucket of water in there. You hydrate yourself with some nice juice. Carrot juice is good. Lots of electrolyte. Beet juice is great. Coconut water is good as well. About 20 minutes of a sauna reduces your risk of stroke. Also, you know what reduces your risk of stroke? In fact, this is one of the studies I did at the Institute of Applied Biology. I was noticing that many of the people that I was counseling had already been given diets by their doctors. So I did a study called the Doctor's Diet Protocols. And to get the actual protocols, we went to all the different hospitals on the Upper East Side, and there are a lot of them, and got the protocols, you know, what they suggest that the doctors give. Remember, the doctors create the diet. The dietitians simply put it together. And I tried the doctor's diet, but had to stop it because the results were disastrous. Clearly, the doctors knew nothing about human biochemistry and what the body actually requires. But in the process, I would take a completely healthy person. In fact, in this case, I used some volunteers from the Natural Living Running and Walking Club, and we'd take a sample of blood on a fasting stomach. They hadn't eaten anything. And you look under it. And there are varying degrees of redness depending upon how much oxygen is the blood. And then they go out and they had one of these doctor diet meals that were frequently high in fat. And they came back, and then about an hour later, we'd take another sample of blood. And there you could just see this, the thickness, the viscosity of the blood had changed tremendously. And you could see the red blood cells aggregating or clumping onto the fat. So that was one of the reasons that I have challenged people who are on these high-fat, high-protein diets. You really risk a heart attack or stroke. That's my absolute belief. Now, think of it this way. If you have some heart problems and they tell you to take a blood thinner and you listen to the side effects, frequently the side effects of a blood thinner is death. But they don't tell you that you could thin your blood with a green vegetable or vegetable juice or watermelon juice and vitamin E, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10. These all thin the blood naturally. I would rather thin the blood naturally throughout the day and protect my body from stroke than to take a drug and keep with an unhealthy diet and then end up having a stroke. That is what we're doing right now. We could change that. Also, from the University of Western Ontario comes research that shows that your gut microbiome, that's your good bacteria, plays an important role in atherosclerosis, which is a leading cause of heart disease. And what they have shown is a novel relationship between intestinal microbiome and all atherosclerosis, one of the major causes of heart attack and stroke. And this was measured as the burden of plaque in the carotid arteries. In order to understand the role that the bacteria in the gut play in atherosclerosis, the researchers examined blood levels of metabolic products of the intestinal microbiome, and they studied a total of 316 people from three distinct groups of patients, and those with about as much plaque as predicted by traditional risk factors, those who seem to be protected from atherosclerosis because they have high levels of traditional risk factors but normal arteries, and those with unexplained atherosclerosis, meaning you don't know why they have it. And what they found was that the patients with the unexplained atherosclerosis had significantly higher blood levels of these toxic metabolites that are produced by the intestinal bacteria. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Atherosclerosis. So what is my takeaway message from this? Good bacteria, good health. Bad bacteria, bad health. Good food, good bacteria. Bad food, bad bacteria. It's that simple, cause and effect. So those who are eating the hot dogs, french fries, hamburgers, pizzas, donuts, bagels, potato chips, bad bacteria in the gut. In fact, let me tell you how bad it is. 100 grams, which is only a little over 3 ounces of, a little less than 3 ounces of sugar, that is enough to suspend upwards of 50% of your immune response for about 3 to 6 hours. Now think of how many times in a day people have sugar, even when they're not aware they're having sugar, because the average person is getting 40 teaspoons of sugar a day. That means that in the entire day you've substantially crippled your immune system. And in a clinical setting, I'll tell you how that works. Many of you will remember the Tri-State Healing Center, first on 84th Street and Riverside Drive, and then down at 72nd and Broadway. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people were helped there, had a wonderful medical staff, but holistic, the best holistic dentist in New York, in my opinion, Dr. Elmira Gadol. And by the way, just as an aside, small world, isn't it? I'm doing a health retreat as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, just a couple weeks ago. And who should be passing through and stopped off with her daughter? Elmira Gadol. Just on the day when I was thinking, I haven't had my teeth looked at. And I was going to make an appointment when I get back to New York. So went into a local holistic dentist and she borrowed the dentist's office to check out the teeth. What a small world. In any case, we had a colon therapist, Mitchell Proffman, one of the best chiropractors in New York. He keeps telling me that, and I say, Mitch, you sure about that? And we had all forms of bio-oxidative therapies, intravenous vitamin therapies. We had about almost 18 staff of medical doctors, nurses. And one of the things that you could find there was that a lot of people had AIDS, HIV infection, AIDS, and they came in the evening from 6 o'clock to midnight. And there would be maybe 50 to 100 a night that would come through there, 7 nights a week. We were open every day of the year. And one of the first things you'd see is thrush. And thrush, when a person really has it bad, where it's systemic, they open their mouth to talk, and it looks like someone stuck cotton balls in their mouth. And you could take a tongue depressor, a wooden tongue depressor, and you just take it back in the mouth, and you could scoop out this thrush, this yeast. And, of course, they would have the yeast overgrowth in their lungs, which could kill them, in their intestines, vaginas. So getting them off all sugars, all refined carbohydrates, and giving them bitter melon juice combined with some Ayurvedics and homeopathics, and the first stage is just detoxing. And that would take sometimes 2, 3, 4 weeks before any of the more pronounced therapies like intravenous therapy occurred. And you could just see a person completely transform their health. You'd start to see a rise in their CD4 levels, CD8s, their immune markers would increase, their vitality, ability to sleep, lesions in the mouth began to heal. It was sugar. That's how bad sugar is. And what they had, they only had bad bacteria. And, of course, they've been taking antibiotics, which destroy all good bacteria in the gut. So when you're on antibiotics and you're having sugar in the diet, you are risking major immune collapse. And we don't even teach that in medical school, the dangers of sugar. So get off the sugar, get off the refined carbohydrates, and watch healthier bacteria grow in your intestine. And that can help your whole body. From our environmental segment from the University of Rochester comes a study that exposure to fracking chemicals in utero can harm the immune system and diminish the ability of female offspring to fend off diseases like multiple sclerosis. That's according to this study. Now, we know there's about 200 chemicals that can be measured in wastewater and surface and groundwater in fracking-dense regions like Pennsylvania. I used to think Pennsylvania was one of the best states in America to live for sustainability and water and really nice people and farmland. Not today. Just way too polluted and too political, and the hydrofracking vested interests have enormous clout there. So, it's no longer a place I would recommend. In any case, this was published in Toxicological Sciences, so just be aware they're pumping millions of gallons of chemical-laden water deep underground to fracture rocks and release oil and gas, and the chemicals come back up, and they leach into your local water supply, they're into your ground where you're growing vegetables, or in the air where you're breathing. Quote from the study, "Our study reveals that there are links between early life exposure to fracking-associated chemicals and damage to the immune system," that particular laboratory study. Something is important. I'm Gary Knoll. We're 20 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. We have a lot more to come. Please stay with us.
Sunshine, blue skies, please go away. A girl has found another and gone away. With her went my future. My life is filled with gloom. So day after day, I stay locked up in my room. I know to you.
Now for commentaries. This first one's from Dr. Bruce Levine, and it's from Alternet, and he says, in my career as a psychologist, I've talked with hundreds of people previously diagnosed by other professionals with oppositional defiant disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, anxiety disorder, and other psychiatric illnesses. And I am struck by how many of these diagnosed are essentially anti-authoritarians, and also how those professionals who have diagnosed them are not. This is a really important statement, because anti-authoritarians question whether an authority is a legitimate one before taking that authority seriously. Evaluating the legitimacy of authorities includes assessing whether or not authorities actually know what they're talking about, are honest, and care about those who are respecting their authority. And when anti-authoritarians assess an authority to be illegitimate, they challenge and resist that authority, sometimes aggressively and sometimes passive-aggressively, sometimes wisely and sometimes not. Some activists lament how few anti-authoritarians there appear to be in the United States. One reason could be that many natural anti-authoritarians are now psychopathologized and medicated before they achieve political consciousness of society's most oppressive authorities. So why mental health professionals diagnose anti-authoritarians as mental illness? Gaining acceptance into graduate school or medical school and achieving a PhD or MD and becoming a psychologist or psychiatrist means jumping through many hoops, many of which require much behavioral and attentional compliance with authorities, even those authorities who lack respect. The selection and socialization of mental health professionals tends to breed out many anti-authoritarians. Degrees and credentials are primarily badges of compliance. Those with extended schooling have lived for many years in a world where one routinely conforms to the demands of authorities. Thus, for many MDs and PhDs, people differ from the way that they perceive attentional and behavioral compliance appear to be from another world, and hence a diagnosed world. I have found that most psychologists and psychiatrists and other mental health professionals are not only extraordinarily compliant with authorities, but also unaware of the magnitude of their obedience. And it also has become clear to me that the anti-authoritarianism of their patients creates enormous anxiety for those professionals, and their anxiety fuels diagnosis and treatments. In graduate school, I discovered that all it took to be labeled as having, quote, issues with authority was not kissing up to a director of clinical training whose personality was a combination of Donald Trump, Newt Gingrich, and Howard Cosell. When I was told by some faculty that I had issues with authority, I had mixed feelings about being so labeled. On the one hand, I found it amusing because among the working-class kids I had grown up with, I was considered relatively compliant with authorities. After all, I had done my homework, studied, and received good grades. However, while my new issues with authority label made me grin because I was now being seen as a bad boy, I was also concerned about just what kind of profession I had entered. Specifically, if somebody such as myself was labeled as having issues with authority, what were they calling the kids I grew up with who paid attention to many things that they cared about but didn't care enough about school to comply there? Well, the answer would soon become clear. A 2009 Psychiatric Times article entitled ADD, ADHD, and ODD, Confronting the Challenges of Disruptive Behavior, reports, quote, disruptive disorders, which include attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and oppositional defiance disorder, are the most common mental health problems of childhood and teenagers. ADHD is defined by poor attention and distractibility, poor self-control and impulsivity, and hyperactivity. ODD is defined as a pattern of negativist, hostile, and defiant behavior without the more serious violations of the basic rights of others that are seen in conduct disorder. Psychologist Russell Barkley, one of the mainstream mental health leaders authorities on ADHD said that those afflicted with ADHD have deficits in what he calls rule-governed behavior, as they are less responsive to rules of established authorities and less sensitive to positive or negative consequences. ODD, oppositional defiance disorder, young people, according to mainstream mental health authorities, also have these so-called deficits in rule-governed behavior. And so it is extremely common for young people to have a dual diagnosis of ADHD and ODD. Do we really want to diagnose and medicate everyone with, quote, deficits in rule-governing behavior? Albert Einstein, as a youth, would have likely received an ADHD diagnosis and maybe an ODD one as well. Albert didn't pay attention to his teachers, failed his college entrance exams twice, and had difficulty holding jobs. However, Einstein's biographer, Carl Clark, author of Einstein, The Life and Times, asserts that Albert's problems did not stem from attention deficit, but rather from his hatred of authoritarian, Prussian discipline in his schools. Einstein said, quote, "The teachers in the elementary school appeared to me like sergeants in the gymnasium. The teachers were like lieutenants." At age 13, Einstein read Kant's Difficult Critique of Pure Reason because he was interested in it. Clark also tells us Einstein refused to prepare himself for college admissions as a rebellion against his father's unbearable path of practical profession. After he did enter college, one professor told Einstein, quote, "You have one fault. One can't tell you anything. The very characteristics of Einstein that upset authorities so much were exactly the ones that allowed him to excel." So, by today's standards, Saul Alinsky, the legendary organizer and author of The Radicals and Rules for Radicals, would have certainly been diagnosed with one or more disruptive disorders. Recalling his childhood, Alinsky said, "I never thought of walking on the grass until I saw a sign saying, 'Keep off the grass.' Then I would stomp all over it." Alinsky also recalls a time when he was 10 or 11 and his rabbi was tutoring him in Hebrew. "One particular day, I read 3 pages in a row without any errors in pronunciation, and suddenly a penny fell on the Bible. Then the next day, the rabbi turned up and told me to start reading, and I wouldn't. I just sat there in silence, refusing to read. He asked me why, and I was so quiet, and I said, 'This time it's a nickel or nothing.' He threw back his arm and slammed me across the room." Many people with severe anxiety or depression also are anti-authoritarians. Often a major pain in the lives that fuels their anxiety or depression is fear that their contempt for illegitimate authorities will cause them to be financially or socially marginalized, but their fear that compliance with such illegitimate authorities will cause them existential death. I've also spent a great deal of time with people who had at one time in their lives had thoughts and behaviors that were so bizarre they were extremely frightening for their families or even themselves. They were diagnosed with schizophrenia or other psychoses, but have fully recovered and have been for many years leading productive lives. And among this population, I have not met one person whom I would not consider a major anti-authoritarian. Once recovered, they have learned to channel their anti-authoritarianism into more constructive political ends, including reforming mental health treatment. And many anti-authoritarians who earlier in their lives were diagnosed with mental illness tell me that once they were labeled with a psychiatric diagnosis, they got caught in a dilemma. Authoritarians, by definition, demand unquestioning obedience, and so any resistance to their diagnosis and treatment created enormous anxiety for authoritarian mental health professionals, and professionals feeling out of control labeled them non-compliant with treatment, increasing the severity of their diagnosis and jacking up their medications. This was enraging for these anti-authoritarians, sometimes so much so that they reacted in ways that made them appear even more frightening to their families. And it goes on from there, but I think you have the message. So how many people amongst us are anti-authoritarians? I certainly am one. Interesting, because I'm doing a series, and just to bring you up to date, part one and part two of Wikipedia, the new internet platform for the new McCarthyism, will be posted later today. I'm encouraging, as well as the audio of the last two programs, I'm encouraging this audience, especially those who are anti-authoritarian, who really revere freedom of choice and freedom of thought, and who are non-compliant when the obedience they're requested of would compromise their integrity and the truth of their being, to start to read these stories and share them with everyone you know. That's how we, the people who have found our conscience, found our truths, and found the ability and the courage to stand up, will not be silenced. Now, those on the other side, the authoritarians, can say, too late, too bad, too little. We are the power. We control the search engines. We control Facebook and Google and all the others. We control the media. We control the talking points. We control the beginning and end of all discussion. So, not going to work. At that point, we then can say that is true for the disempowered, compliant majority. It is not true for the highly empowered minority. And all change historically throughout all of time has come from the empowered minority, not the majority. So let us begin to share the resources for social change. The first step is education from quality information that has been fully vetted, is completely accurate with footnotes. Part one and part two of the articles, they're up today. Share them everywhere. You never know when someone who is a policymaker and opinion leader will see the truth in it. For example, what if you had a profile of you that you didn't put up there, but someone who doesn't like you put up on Wikipedia, and you went ahead and you followed their rules and you went through the editing process to try to change it. And every time you changed the inaccuracies, it came back the same. You wouldn't know until you heard this two-part series I just did that behind the scenes in the area of health and medicine, nutrition, and all chiropractic and homeopathy and all the other alternative disciplines, there's a small clique of people called the skeptics who literally have control over what gets edited or not. They pride themselves, but they have not been exposed. Now they've been exposed. Already they're fighting back. They were on the internet this morning yelling and screaming. That's fine. Let them. But we have the truth. Now, once we know that Wikipedia is no longer a legitimate source, I'll be giving you tomorrow legitimate websites to go to. I can give you two right now. Probably the best on anything involving health is Sayer G's Green Med Info. Green Med Info. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of peer-reviewed articles supporting a healthy lifestyle, plant-based diets, supplements, and alternative therapies. Late last night, my producer, I'm in one part of the country, he's in another, we were both watching a new documentary that has not been released yet, and then we've been in communication with the producer, because now we have at least 1,076 clinical studies, 2,300 articles, all highly regarded, including double-blind, placebo-controlled, meeting the gold standard on the legitimacy and safety and accuracy of homeopathy. You would never know homeopathy had a single good thing written about it. But it does. You're just not made aware of it. You've been going to the wrong sources. You've been going to authoritarian sources that are the guardians of the gate. Remember what I said, there's two types of science. The science I believe in, and all the people in the alternative movement believe in, and all the chiropractors and homeopaths believe in, and all the holistic medical doctors and holistic dentists and holistic nurses believe in, and that is evidence-based science or evidence-based medicine, both. Which means that, okay, you say the diet can change disease, prove it. Good. And you prove it, and then you publish it. And then others can take that and using your protocols and come up with similar results. That means that now you've proven it. You have a right to exist. You have a right to have people benefit from that therapy. And that's what historically we have had. But now we have usurping all of this, taking control over the whole field of medicine and health and science, is a small clique. Ideologically and politically and economically frequently associated with the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industrial complex, that says, no, 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 because if you find that you've done 20 studies in a row and you can reverse arthritis with diet, we don't want that. We'll say, no, there is no such thing. We only want you taking a methotrexate or Vioxx for your arthritis. Ours is science-based medicine. Ours rules. The media will follow us. The government will follow us. Insurance companies follow us, not you. You won't get coverage. You won't get credibility, even if you cure people. So there's a battle between what we all should support, evidence-based medicine, evidence-based science, and the new usurpers, the people who have taken control over all of healthcare, medicine, and science, science-based medicine. They're a tiny little clique. Ahead of the curve is the American public that has learned. Think of all the parents that learned, I believed in science-based medicine. I gave my child, who were healthy, normal, the vaccines. Now they've got autism or brain damage. I believe that the standard American diet was good, or you wouldn't be advertising it all in the mainstream television programs. And so I tried the mainstream diet, and I ended up morbidly obese with diabetes and a heart disease and a stroke. You lied to me. You used me. You used my inability to challenge your authority. I'm not an anti-authoritarian. I'm the average person. I'm compliant. And think of how few of the 900,000 doctors are anti-authoritarian, because they dare not challenge these people. These people are really, really tough. But in true science, there is always room for a better idea, and it can change the paradigm. So imagine now, tell everyone that this coming Monday will be the most definitive radio program ever done, with a follow-up article with thousands of footnotes from all the studies on homeopathy. So we will talk back truth to those who believe that homeopathy has no basis, just water, just garbage. No, it's not. But here's a chance to show your anti-authoritarian and your consumer activist mettle. Show that you have the strength of character. First, do your homework. Read. Listen. Challenge. Study. And then share. And the key is share, share, share. For example, right now, just yesterday, our newest film, The Deadly Deception, won another major award. And then on this Sunday week, it won the Gold Award in the Houston International World Fest, one of the most respected film festivals in the world, and as best documentary. I'd like for you to go to Gary Nall's YouTube, download it, watch it, and share it. For the journalists in this audience, the citizen journalists, watch it and then do short articles from there and throw it out onto the internet so that the experts in the film, the toxicologists, who say something very common sense. Every study in the world shows mercury's toxic. Every study ever published shows mercury's toxic. If you went into your doctor's office and said, put the amount of mercury that's in that vaccine, flu vaccine, into a spoon and let me drink it, that person would be arrested, lose their license. Put it into a vaccine is perfectly acceptable. And they're saying, this is stupid. It's still toxic. Of course it is. But that's how toxic the mindset of American Orthodox medicine has become. It fails miserably. It fails constantly. Our war on cancer, we're winning the war on cancer. Well, then tell that to the 550,000 Americans you toe-tagged this year, gave them a $200,000 to $300,000 medical bill, and they're dead. If you were rewarded only when you cured patients, there wouldn't be a hospital in America open for business nor an oncologist anywhere allowed to practice. The emperor is naked, and we can't bring ourselves, because of our pro-authoritarian principles, to accept that. Anti-authoritarian, you look for the truth and you speak it. So let's start sharing information, because they've got bots and trolls by the gazillion out there contaminating the airways. When they attack me, for example, they put a profile up on their website, which has been read by millions of people. As a result, they probably won't want to come and listen to this radio program or read a book or read an article because, oh, I read all this bad stuff about you or negative stuff about you on Wikipedia. Do you know how many times we tried to change that using their rules, playing by their rules. Not once would they allow anything to be changed. And who's the so-called expert that put all that negative stuff up? One, Stephen Barrett. So here's what I've done. We went through and we methodically took every single sentence in my profile on Wikipedia and we deconstructed and showed it's all nonsense. And we put the truth and we sent that to Wikipedia and they refused to do anything about it. So I posted that. That's now posted on prn.fm under investigations and you can read it. You can also read an article about Stephen Barrett where they some journalists took a look at Stephen Barrett's claims and my claims and show that Barrett was wrong on every single point, that he has no expertise in the areas that he is challenging us on, none. In fact, the California court showed that he was not an expert and was very biased. So how is Wikipedia using a completely biased person when their own rules show you can't use biased information from biased people? Well, that shows the hypocrisy. Go and read it. See the truth for yourself. So the next time some cracker nut job says, oh, well, I read this about Dr. such and such or Dr. such, or even Gary and all, say, no, I've read the truth, you haven't. In which case you have the truth. In fact, one of the things, when they couldn't attack me on anything else, they tried to attack me about my degree. Big mistake for a lot of people because I sued them and I won. But who was the person that spread that information? Stephen Barrett. Let me read you what they said. I just got this morning. This is from my graduate school. And you never hear anyone else being attacked ever about where they went to school. Me, yes. This is to Stephen Barrett and his Quack Watch. That's who they use as an expert in Wikipedia. This is from Union Institute and University, Vice President of University Relations. Dear Dr. Barrett, I'm writing to correct inaccuracies and misinformation published on your Quack Watch website and to express Union Institute's pride in its 18,000 alumni. Union Institute and University provides educational programs and services exemplary quality to adults. Established in 1964, it was first known as Union for Research and Experimental and Higher Experimentation and Higher Education. The founding liberal arts colleges consortium members are Antioch University, Bard College, Goddard College, Hofstra University, Wayne State University, Northeastern University, Sarah Lawrence College, and Stevens College. By the way, those are all outstanding colleges. That's who created my graduate school. And since 1985, Union is accredited by the North Central Association of Schools and Colleges and a commission of the Higher Learning Commission. The national standard for each academic degree is the same for institutions accredited by the Higher Learning Commission, and our status of accreditation acknowledged that the university's degrees meet the standards required. What this is meaning is if you went to Harvard and you got a PhD and you went to Union and got a PhD, they are virtually the same as far as the standard. So this idea that somehow you get your degree is more significant or better accredited at one school over another is just nonsense. It's a lie. Further, every doctoral student in higher education in the United States has the responsibility for choosing their field of study. It is misleading and a disservice to all doctoral programs across the country to say otherwise. Among the university's many distinctions, Union Institute University is ranked 10th among U.S. colleges and universities for conferring doctoral degrees in all disciplines to African Americans, according to Black Issues in Higher Education. Union Institute University is classified by the Carnegie Foundation as a doctoral research university intensive, and were ranked first among national doctoral universities in the category highest proportion of classes with under 20 in U.S. News and World Reports, America's Best Colleges, etc. Union graduates have also been leaders. Currently, 67 doctoral alumni graduates are sitting or former presidents of colleges and universities around the world. Then it goes on to some of the exemplary famous people who graduated also from there. These are heavyweight people. And finally, she says, the university considers Dr. Knoll as one of the stellar alumni and he exemplifies learners and alumni who are independent thinkers with the courage to challenge convention, break new ground, and find new paths of inquiry, end quote. Here's what you will not find on Wikipedia. The reason I chose my graduate school, I could have gone just about anywhere I wanted, was I did not like the idea of going into a conformist school, doing a conformist degree, sitting bored to death in a class, listening to a professor tell me what I should know. I had to go through a lot of people, Dr. Albert Ellis, Dr. Don Mullen, Dr. Carl Humiston, a lot of people to find out, Lane Kahn, what would be the best school for someone like myself who wants a challenge, because I wanted to do an interdisciplinary degree. And that meant that I couldn't do that in most schools. They won't allow you to do it. So I was the first in the university's history to do this interdisciplinary degree. No one had ever done a PhD program in human nutrition and public health science. Most people, like one of my brother's wife went to Columbia and graduated, had one member on her doctoral committee. I had nine. And they were tough. You had to have consensus in everything you did or you couldn't go forward. And some of the, we would do intensive from 8 in the morning till 8 at night for 10 straight days in Washington, D.C., in Atlanta, and in Chicago, and different places in subject matter that we had to do intensive work in. Plus, we had to do original research, and I did mine at the Institute of Applied Biology on caffeinism. And I was writing definitive work in the areas of complementary healing. And that was the first in their history. And I was stalled and stymied. I had a lot of antagonism until one day I remember getting a call, and it was from one of the three top people at the university, and this gentleman said, "You sure you want to stay here? Because I can say with absolute certainty that there is gross bias against you and what you stand for with members of your doctoral committee, and they're not going to let you through." And I said, "Well, isn't there supposed to be an element of we're here to provide a challenge to the learner? And a PhD means you have to learn and provide an excellence of field." That's what it's called, excellence of field, that you've contributed something unique. "Well, why can't they judge that?" "Well, they're biased. They've got political bias about anything that has the word alternative on it." And then he called back about a day later, and he says, "But there is one little catch." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You know how they won't let you go forward unless every single one of the doctoral committee members agree to your faculty, agree to everything, and they can stall you for a year, and you could take 12 years to get out of the university." And by the way, in some of these intensive, I spoke with graduates seeking their PhD who have been there 9 years. So he says, "However, there's another part of that that no one ever knows about." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "They must also answer within a very short period of time your questions to them." "Really?" "Well, guess who wrote them 300-page questions?" "Me." And that really pissed them off until they wanted to do intensives and they wanted me to... They did not like the fact I was challenging them, and they had to or dismiss themselves from the being on my faculty. Anyhow, I finally got through the university, got my PhD, but I was so disdainful for how I was treated as a rebel, as an anti-authoritarian, bringing a new insight into how to heal the body and diseases that can be prevented, that I refused to go to graduation. I asked Dr. Janet Yanino, I said, "Take a broom, put a cap and gown on it, go up and accept my degree with a broom. Just hold it up, let the people see." And if anybody asks, "What the hell is that?" Just say, "This is a guy who was not happy with how he was treated." Okay, fine. Didn't hear anything. 2 years later, I got a call. "Gary, would you have time to come down to a little meeting we're having?" "Who?" "Well, just a few of us from the university want to have a meeting with you." "Why?" "I don't want anything more to do with you." "No. Well, we apologize for the past. It's a new day. Just, and so, okay." I said, "All right." I wasn't busy that night. So I went downtown, the South Street Seaport. There's a restaurant there. And I went inside, and it was upstairs. And I got up there, and guess what? Here was the whole top management, the dean and provost, all these people at the university. And they gave me, and I have it, the first alumni in the university's entire history to get Outstanding Alumni in Excellence Award. You won't see that anywhere, will you? Didn't know that, did you? I don't like to bring these things up, but when you see what they write about me and then you know the truth of it, and I'm the only student in the history of a highly respected university to get an Outstanding Excellence in Scholarship, but boy, they don't want to say anything good about you. They don't want to say that I've won more documentary awards than any other documentary in world history. They don't want to talk about the quality of those documentaries, what it means to defy different industries. They don't want to know what you're good at, what you've done, what is your benevolence, what is your philanthropic, what is your original that you've contributed. They don't want to talk about how many different experiments I did at the Institute of Applied Biology where I disproved science and created whole new paradigms, like with you don't have to eat animal proteins to get your amino acids. That was my work and a lot of other works. So you see, their intent is to cause people to lose trust, to lose faith. And that's the people behind the scenes. And they have a political agenda, in my opinion. But the truth is something they can't handle. We're going to finish off today's show by telling you who John Bolton really is and why you should be very concerned. Here he is.
That's John Bolton, a veteran of both Bush administrations, one of the primary architects of the lie that started the war in Iraq, and President Trump's third national security advisor. Bolton was born in Baltimore to a working-class family, but got scholarships to the elite private military academy, McDonough School, where he first got into conservative politics. McDonough history teacher Marty McKibben said he used to have friendly debates with Bolton about things like the Vietnam War, which Bolton ardently supported. The students then were conservative, much more than they are now, but John went beyond conservative. Behind McKibben's back, Bolton referred to him as Mao McKibben. Bolton was an enthusiastic student organizer for Barry Goldwater's presidential campaign.
I have no question that had I voted for that bill, I might have softened some of the Negro opposition to my candidates.
Bolton's pro-war attitudes went with him to Yale, where most students were protesting against the war in Vietnam and for civil rights. Bolton wrote in his autobiography of that time that he felt like a space alien, and the protesters could damn well get out of my way as I walked to class. But his support of the Vietnam War ended when it became his problem. Bolton joined the National Guard to avoid the draft. I confess I had no desire to die in a Southeast Asian rice paddy. I considered the war in Vietnam already lost, he wrote in a Yale reunion book. After undergrad, he stayed at Yale for law school and interned for President Nixon's first vice president, Spiro T. Agnew, who would resign in shame during a criminal investigation. One of Bolton's old friends remembered that even in college, Bolton aspired to be the highest-ranking non-elected official in the government. And Bolton would create a career out of slipping into powerful non-elected positions. He was appointed by President Ronald Reagan to the Agency for International Development.
You'll teach him to sleep in a bed, to eat with a spoon, and make patty cakes? What will that prove?
What if I could teach this monkey the difference between right and wrong?
The agency responsible for foreign aid for needy countries. Bolton said his goal there was to turn aid away from a welfare-oriented approach known as basic human needs and make it more market-driven. Another goal of his, apparently, was to verbally abuse his colleagues. One employee said he tried to force her to lobby for less regulations on baby formula in developing nations. She refused, citing studies that formula is dangerous in developing nations because of lack of access to clean water. The employee alleges Bolton shouted that Nestle, a maker of formula, was an important company, and then screamed that she was fired.
Nestle makes the very best chocolate.
He didn't have the power to fire her, though, so she was moved to a basement office as punishment. Around this time, he was taken under the wing of Reagan Chief of Staff James Baker and North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, famous for this ad.
You needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota.
Bolton himself would fail to get a job, too, for a very different reason. Accounts of his verbal abuse spread, and he was reportedly denied a partnership at his old law firm because of allegations of anger issues and emotional abuse. That, however, didn't preclude him from continuing to have powerful positions in subsequent Republican administrations. But then,
the American people have voted to make a new beginning.
Bolton spent part of the Clinton presidency, what he called the wilderness years, working for conservative think tank the American Enterprise Institute. alongside right-wing luminaries like Dinesh D'Souza and Dick Cheney. And then something happened in Florida.
There will be lots of suspicions on both sides about the networks making the early call, the late count that is going on, the missing ballot boxes in Broward County. And if it comes down to be just a few thousand votes, then we'll probably end up in court in Florida.
Bolton was pulled onto the team making sure the guy who lost the popular vote won the election. He was dispatched to Florida to oversee the recount, scrutinizing votes for Vice President Gore and working to swing the election towards Governor George W. Bush. This is where he first got national recognition, as America looked at recount photos and wondered, who is this man and why does his mustache look like that? Bush would take Florida by 537 votes and win the election. Bush would return the favor by bringing Bolton into his State Department as Under Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs. In this position, Bolton would play a key role in convincing the administration and America that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, triggering events that led to the war in Iraq, a virtually universally derided conflict that Bolton stands by to this day. In more minor warmongering, Bolton delayed diplomatic talks with North Korea, pushed for a resolution to threaten Iran, worked to destroy a ballistic missile treaty with Russia, went AWOL on important meetings about stopping nuclear proliferation, and despite seeming to care a lot about stopping the spread of weapons of mass destruction, derailed the Biological Weapons Convention, refusing to allow inspectors to look at U.S. weapons plants. The lack of U.S. participation castrated the convention, leaving nothing in place to stop the spread of those weapons worldwide. During his tenure, he made a few things clear. He didn't care about the lives or well-being of foreign nationals. He always considered war the best option, and he hated the United Nations. In 2005, he was nominated to be the ambassador to the United Nations. His confirmation hearings were incredibly dramatic. Bolton was accused of having a temper, and his abusive treatment of staff was discussed at length, including this by a young senator from Illinois.
Trying to get a sense of whether this person's temperament or his veracity is such that it would justify placing him in such a sensitive position.
He was also accused of trying to claim Cuba had biological weapons and then tried to fire a biological weapons expert who said that wasn't true. He was asked what he would do in hindsight to stop or slow down the Rwandan genocide and made it about logistics rather than the massive loss of life.
And at that time, knowing all that you know now, what action would you have taken?
I'm not sure that I can honestly answer that, Senator, because we don't know logistically whether it would have been possible to do anything different than what the administration did at the time.
The two-day hearing led to many Republicans pulling their support for him, and he was not confirmed. But President W. slipped him in anyway as a recess appointment, giving him a temporary role.
And there's five more minutes you can listen to on PRN.FM. Mind you, that is right now the president's national security advisor. Whoa. Talk about the fox in the chicken coop. That's it. Anyhow, more to come. Let's start looking at the material and sharing it. Look and share. Read and share. We have the power because we are concerned about the truth. The average person is just lost in a fog of this blissful internet lifestyle. We're not. We're still out there raising hell. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.